Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
An early spring wind howled through the drafty corridors of the castle. In one small but richly appointed room, its walls hung with expensive Flemish tapestries, shouting echoed off the stone walls. My cousin, the King of France, sends his lackeys to collect taxes that don't belong to him. He claims royal rights that do not exist, and he insults me in my own lands. The yeller wore expensive black-dyed velvet. His face was handsome, thin lips below a broken nose, framed with auburn hair, but twisted into an expression of rage and reddened with anger. Charles the Bold, Count of Charolais, heir to the powerful Duke of Burgundy, was not a happy man in the spring of 1464. He grabbed a jug of wine off a table and hurled it at the wall. It shattered against the stone. Red wine stained the delicately colored threads of a tapestry. Two men dressed in pricey and multicolored riding clothes, stained with early spring mud, faced the Count. They blanched at his rage. Charles the Bold was known to have a temper. He had recently broken a friend's nose with a thrown boot in a fit of anger. This was shaping up to be a spectacular episode. "Fetch me scribes and messengers," said the Count. The two mud-stained men, grateful for any excuse to leave, hurried out as quickly as they could. Charles the Bold gathered himself. The color was leaving his face, replaced by a steely concentration. His scarred hands clenched and unclenched. "Fetch me pen and paper," he said to a servant who snapped to the task. Hours later, the hooves of horses clattered onto the road that led out of the castle. Messengers were heading for the great nobles of France. The Duke of Bourbon, the Duke of Brittany, the Duke of Lorraine, the King's brother, the Duke of Berry, and many, many more. All of the most important political players in the realm. The Count of Charolais was piqued, and his anger was a terrible thing. His rights had been violated by the king. That was no small matter. The king was powerful, but so too were the princes. Charles the Bold, soon to be ruling for his elderly father, the Duke of Burgundy, was the most powerful of them all. Civil war was on its way to France. In the second half of the 15th century, civil wars and political instability struck every major kingdom in Western Europe. From England to Aragon, the dominant theme of the time was breakdown. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, I'm Patrick Wyman. Welcome to another episode of Tides of History. Thanks for joining me. Over the last two episodes of Tides of History, we've gone into depth on the Wars of the Roses. Between the 1430s and the 1490s, political strife rocked England, which had been the most stable and tightly governed kingdom in Europe for generations. Central government fell apart. Simmering political tensions occasionally spilled over into shocking bouts of violence. Between executions and deaths on the battlefield, these conflicts decimated the ranks of the politically powerful nobility and killed tens of thousands of the more humble. The Wars of the Roses are famous. They've got a cool name. Shakespeare wrote some of his finest plays about them. They inspired George R.R. Martin's Game of Thrones series. What's less known is that practically every European kingdom, not just England, was racked by serious bouts of infighting in the second half of the 15th century. Everywhere from the North Sea to the Mediterranean, the years between 1450 and about 1490 were absolutely full of secret cabals of powerful nobles, succession crises, and open warfare between factions. This is supposed to be the time of the rise of the state. It's supposed to be a prelude to the practically omnipotent monarchs of the early 16th century, guys like Charles V of Spain and the Holy Roman Empire, Francis I of France, and Henry VIII of England. So, how can the period that's supposed to be about the growth of state power feature civil wars so prominently? And why did this stuff seem to be happening everywhere all at once? That's what we're going to set out to answer today. Over the next three episodes, we're going to complete the journey through late medieval politics that we started with the Wars of the Roses. Through them, and especially through today's episode, we're going to talk about the forces that pulled kingdoms apart. In the next couple of weeks' episodes, we'll try to understand what forged the states we're familiar with, what brought them together. I have to start by acknowledging my debt to a historian named John Watts, who wrote a really excellent book on this period called The Making of Polities. He's the one who pointed out that all these civil wars were happening more or less simultaneously, and that that wasn't a coincidence. This has deep implications for how we understand the Europe of this period, and the Europe that eventually exploded outward onto the global stage at the beginning of the 16th century. The premise for this episode comes from him. There are three themes that we'll be following throughout this episode. These are things that we've already discussed a little bit in the episodes on the Wars of the Roses, and they'll show up again in the next couple of episodes as well. That's because they're the foundations for understanding how politics actually worked in this period. First, all politics in the second half of the 15th century was personal politics. To some extent, that's true even today, but we have more formal institutions, things like political parties and bureaucracies, that mediate and shape those politics. At this point, the character traits of members of the political elite were vitally important. The king's charisma or lack of it, intelligence or weakness, cowardice or bravery, sexual impotence or lechery, a lord's vindictiveness or arrogance, all of these personal characteristics had a direct effect on late medieval politics. Beyond the individual level, personal relationships among the elite were the basic substance of political life. Lifelong ties between major lords, friendships forged on the battlefield or enmities born at a royal court dinner, they defined whole eras. Even more important was kinship. Ties of blood and marriage created both alliances and conflicts. Some king's sons and heirs were their father's most loyal allies. Others were the king's greatest enemies. Some princes and lords cooperated closely with their brothers and cousins. Others betrayed them. Collecting family inheritances was a serious pastime for medieval nobles. Family quarrels between country lords spilled over into problems for entire kingdoms. So, for example, I'm sure you have that one cousin you don't like. For whatever reason, you have some serious beef. Now, imagine you could settle those differences by getting together a bunch of friends and hacking each other to pieces with swords. Things like that weren't quirks or side effects of late medieval politics. They were late medieval politics. It was all a family affair, and it was all personal. So we have personal politics. The second big theme to bear in mind is that pretty much all conflict in medieval politics was essentially about rights. Everybody in the game, from the king to the high nobles to the lesser nobles to other players like incorporated towns, made claims about their rights. Rights to tax, rights to enforce laws in general, or rights to enforce a specific law. Rights to own a lordship or an estate. Rights to exercise a particular royal power. Rights to a particular office, and so on and so on. The language of rights was everywhere. A king wasn't so much a king as he happened to be the person making the best claim to the rights of being king at any given time. You see the difference? When different players claimed the same right or disagreed about who had what rights, then conflict was the result. The rights in question could be anything from a minor inheritance to being subject to a particular law to who got to be the king of a major kingdom. Everybody involved in politics at this point was incredibly touchy about these rights, and with good reason. Finally, each of the kingdoms of Western Europe in this period was less a coherent state in the sense that we understand one than a jumble of competing forces. Now, royal power was special. This was something pretty much everybody increasingly agreed on in the second half of the 15th century. But a king only exercised royal power and royal rights alongside or in competition with a whole bunch of other folks claiming power and rights. If a king wanted to tax, he probably had to negotiate with a representative body, like Parliament in England or the Estates General in France. If a king wanted to extend royal justice, lords, who offered their own brand of justice, might not appreciate the competition. If a king wanted to go to war with a neighboring kingdom, his most important princes might have ideas of their own about what should be done with foreign policy. Even more than that, those great lords might have links of their own, marriages, alliances, trading deals, and the like, in that neighboring kingdom. There was no reason the Duke of York couldn't marry his son to the daughter of the Duke of Burgundy. The city of Liège, surrounded by the Duke of Burgundy's territory, could negotiate with the King of France. The estates of Catalonia within the Kingdom of Aragon could appeal to the King of France or Castile for aid. The Earl of Warwick, a peer of England, could accept a financial pension from the King of France. Those things were well within their rights. Late medieval kingdoms were just much less coherent than modern states. The firm division that we intuitively grasp between internal and external politics just didn't exist. In the case of an emergency, say a civil war, great nobles or towns or what have you could leverage their ties to political actors outside their own kingdom to advance their agenda. The upshot was that if a king was too young, too incompetent, or just plain didn't get along with the nobles, it was easy for things to fall to pieces. Kings had to actively wield royal power. If they couldn't or wouldn't, nobody was bound to respect their claims to the rights that we talked about. Other political actors, especially the great nobles or foreign kings, could and did step up to fill the void. So, these are the three big themes: politics as personal and family business, claims to rights, and the basic incoherence of kingdoms as political units. As we break down each of the major civil wars of this period, bear these themes in mind. We'll start with the Wars of the Roses in England. We've already covered them, but they provide good examples of each of these themes. The Wars of the Roses were the direct product of the incompetence of King Henry VI, first as a child, controlled by a regency council, and later a vacant adult, controlled by a series of powerful nobles and then his wife, Queen Margaret of Anjou. Henry simply could not exercise his royal authority. To make matters worse, nobody else could legitimately wield royal authority either. This was the direct cause of 5 decades of political crisis and occasionally open civil war. The first contender for Henry VI's crown was Richard, Duke of York. Richard lost his head to the forces of Queen Margaret, the wife of Henry VI, but Richard's son became King Edward IV. Edward IV managed to rule for more than 20 years, from 1461 to 1483, but he constantly had to defend his crown on the battlefield. The whole period of instability only came to an end when a virtual unknown, an exile named Henry Tudor, killed the usurping Richard III at the Battle of Bosworth in 1485. By marrying King Edward IV's daughter and ruthlessly destroying any other potential contenders, Henry Tudor managed to keep his grip on the throne. The specific way England's political crisis played out was strongly connected to the kingdom's unique circumstances. England was the most tightly governed and coherent kingdom in this period. There was a long tradition of effective royal government and strong institutions to help the king exercise his will. The sinews linking the political center and the king to the counties and towns were more developed than they were in France or Castile at this point. England's great nobles were the least powerful and the least independent of the king. They had the fewest links with other kingdoms. But despite all that, we saw how England could basically dissolve under the right circumstances. The Wars of the Roses were the product of twin crises of authority and legitimacy. The kings of England had acquired a ton of rights, privileges, and responsibilities. Henry VI was just personally incapable of exercising those rights, but the kingdom demanded that somebody had to do it. There were wars to fight, there were taxes to collect, there were disputes to resolve. Government existed to do all that. That was the crisis of authority. The question was who was going to do it. The crisis of legitimacy came about in trying to figure out who that was going to be. Who, by what right, on what basis of power, and to the benefit of which people within England. The conflicts over those two things lay behind 5 decades of seesawing political crisis. But the Wars of the Roses were just one of the civil wars that rocked this period. Next, let's travel across the English Channel to France.
If you travel for work, you know to pack 2 suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
The King of France wasn't happy. This was not an unusual state of affairs for Louis XI. He was 4 years into his reign and had just turned 42 years old. Louis had spent most of his adult life pursuing a singular agenda. being king. This was easier said than done. Louis's father, King Charles VII, had hated his son and heir. For nearly 30 years, from the time he was old enough to be a political player, Charles VII had tried, and largely succeeded, in sidelining Louis. When Charles finally died, Louis shed no tears at his father's passing. He wasted no time taking over, either, and pursued a much more forceful path than his father had. Louis's agenda included adept foreign diplomacy, strongly enforcing royal rights, and reining in the great princes of France. These big-time nobles, guys like the Dukes of Brittany and Burgundy, had an independent streak a mile wide and a strong sense of their own importance. They hated Louis for limiting them. Louis loved reigning on their parades. By now, Louis was used to having enemies. It just wasn't every day that he intended to face them face to face. On this hot and humid morning in July of 1465, the air was still and sticky. The enemy, at this point, was a warlike, rage-filled, and humorless 33-year-old by the name of Charles the Bold, the particularly angry gentleman we met back at the very beginning of this episode. Charles was the Count of Charolais. But more importantly, he was the son and heir of the old Duke of Burgundy. The Duke of Burgundy was simultaneously a semi-independent ruler of his own territories, including Flanders and the Netherlands, and also one of the most important nobles of France. The current Duke of Burgundy was an elderly man named Philip the Good. Philip had ruled his territories for nearly 50 years and played his political cards as savvily as anybody in the Middle Ages. He had first forged an alliance with the English during the Hundred Years' War, then broke it to seal the fate of the English in France. That was a long and substantial political shadow. Charles the Bold was ready to step out of his father's accomplished legacy and forge one of his own. Resisting King Louis's attempts to extend French royal power was a pretty good way of making his own name. So Charles the Bold formed an organization of disaffected French nobles, the League of the Public Weal, the Public Good. They set out to make war on Louis XI. July 16, 1465, dawned bright and humid. In a field in northern France, Charles the Bold had drawn up more than 20,000 soldiers. Mercenary English bowmen protected by sharpened stakes. The best artillery in Europe safe behind ditches and breastworks. Chivalrous men-at-arms on neighing, pawing war horses, protected by the most expensive plate armor imported from the workshops of northern Italy. It was a formidable army. Charles the Bold was already an experienced soldier, and he had a connoisseur's taste for late medieval war. They already outnumbered Louis's forces. If Charles's ally, the Duke of Brittany, reached the battlefield, the king would be crushed between them. Charles the Bold's cannon boomed a welcome to Louis's army, tearing bloody holes in the lines of the king's mounted men-at-arms. Men and horses screamed. Champions of chivalry on both sides rode out into the gap between the two armies, fighting each other in valiant single combats. Cheers sounded from the ranks at each victory. Finally, as the afternoon sun rose high in the sky, the two lines finally crashed together. Armored men-at-arms on steel-clad horses slammed into one another at full speed, lances skittering off steel plate and punching into vulnerable flesh. Arrows whizzed through the air. Cannonballs plowed through the unfortunate. The Grand Bastard of Burgundy, the illegitimate half-brother of Charles the Bold, personally speared King Louis's horse with a lance. The king barely survived, surrounded by his bodyguard of Scotsmen, but hundreds of his soldiers were fleeing the battlefield. Then the tide surged back in the other direction. Now it was Burgundians who were fleeing, and a band of French men-at-arms charged at Charles the Bold. A sword blow sliced into his neck, and he was very nearly captured. Battered and bruised, leaving thousands of dead on the field, both sides retreated to their original positions. The Battle of Montelieri was a bloody draw, and it wouldn't be the last clash between Louis XI and Charles the Bold. In fact, this was more the beginning of the political instability that plagued France during this period than the end or even the middle. The roots of these conflicts went deep down into the basic political structures of the Kingdom of France. They wouldn't be fully resolved until well into the 16th century. If you think back to our episodes on the Hundred Years' War, you'll remember that France had a king named John the Good. Despite his nickname, John wasn't particularly good at either ruling or fighting. He was captured by the English on the battlefield at Poitiers in 1356, and his ransom bankrupted the kingdom. John did, however, have four sons who were actually pretty good at ruling and fighting. One of them, Charles V, inherited the throne in 1364 and managed to turn around the disastrous Hundred Years' War. For the others, who weren't going to be king, John the Good carved out large landed endowments and major titles. One of them became Duke of Berry, another became Duke of Anjou, and the third, an intelligent, driven, and hot-headed young man named Philip the Bold, became Duke of Burgundy. These princes of the blood, as they were known, were the most important noblemen in France. The Duke of Berry was mostly content to hang out and collect expensive art and books, but the Dukes of Anjou and Burgundy had additional aspirations. I mentioned before how nobles could wear several hats simultaneously. There was no contradiction between being a French prince of the blood and also holding lands outside France. The Duke of Anjou, for example, quickly got himself a claim to the Kingdom of Naples in Italy, which he and his heirs would spend generations pursuing. That claim would also have some other really important long-term effects, which we'll talk about in coming months. At the same time, the Duke of Burgundy married the heiress to the County of Flanders. By marrying her, Philip the Bold acquired not only Flanders, but also a bunch of other lands, including Holland and the piece of Burgundy that was part of the Holy Roman Empire. These territories were outside the Kingdom of France. We're actually going to do a whole episode about Burgundy next, so we won't go into too much depth here. But the key point to remember is that nobles like Philip the Bold, his successor John the Fearless, you might remember him as the guy who got his skull caved in with an axe during the Hundred Years' War in an assassination, and then Philip the Good were doing a whole bunch of things simultaneously. They were princes of French royal blood who held huge lands inside France, namely the Duchy of Burgundy and the County of Artois. This gave them a strong and ongoing interest in how the kingdom was run. They were also rulers of other territories in their own right, which gave them the kind of power base that could challenge the king himself. By the early 1460s, the Dukes of Burgundy were some of the most powerful people in Europe, but they occupied an odd position. In some lands, they were practically independent, but in others, they were sworn vassals of the King of France. This made them the natural ringleaders of any potential revolt against royal power. Other powerful and independent-minded princes, like the Dukes of Brittany and Bourbon, might not have their separate power base, but they shared any possible frustrations with an overbearing king. Old Charles VII, the father of Louis XI and the man who had eventually won the Hundred Years' War, had walked a tightrope of relations with the princes. There had been some discontent, but most of his problems with his subordinates had actually focused on his son Louis. As early as 1440, when Louis was just 16, Louis had tried to lead a revolt against his father on behalf of the princes. This revolt failed, and Louis was kind of welcomed back into the fold, but after this, Charles VII always kept a close eye on his son and heir. Relations between the two eventually got bad enough that Louis was forced to flee France for the protection of the Duke of Burgundy, Philip the Good. That was where Louis was when his father died in 1461. Charles VII had seen France through the wars with England and brought the kingdom back from the brink of disintegration, but he hadn't been an especially forceful advocate of royal rights. In fact, his strategy had mostly been to let the princes jockey with each other for control of royal government. Louis XI had other ideas. An army of royal officials went out into the counties and duchies and set about enforcing his royal prerogatives by every legal means. Very soon after taking the throne, Louis picked a high-profile fight with the Duke of Brittany about a royal prerogative in appointing clergy. The actual issue was pretty obscure, but the principle at stake wasn't. Could the king interfere in the internal workings of a duchy? Or was that up to a duke within his own territory? Both sides were making claims to rights, and they would have to fight it out. Louis XI was a wily and sophisticated political operator. He earned the nickname the Universal Spider for the webs he wove. But he had not anticipated that his quarrel with the Duke of Brittany might provoke a serious reaction from the other princes. On a more basic level, Louis was an outsider to the game of princely politics. He had spent his entire adult life prior to becoming king in exile of one kind or another, either tucked away in his own lands or in some obscure castle someplace. There had been few opportunities to hang out at court and build long-term alliances, long-term relationships with these other players. On top of that, Louis disdained the public rituals and conspicuous, expensive consumption of court life. He hated fancy clothes and parties. Outside of working, which he did incessantly, the only thing Louis cared for was hunting. All of this meant that Louis missed a basic part of how politics worked among nobles. He didn't truly grasp the personal relationship dimension to the game. This was the exact opposite of Edward IV of England, who loved parties and womanizing and public rituals. Edward's nobles had loved him for that. But even when Louis had been in exile with the Duke of Burgundy, Louis's incessant scheming and dislike of public occasions had eventually put him on the outs with his host. Charles the Bold, the son of that Duke of Burgundy, had thought Louis was plotting with his enemies and competing for his father's affections, and hated him all the more. For Charles the Bold, this was personal. So from the moment that Louis took the throne, he was headed for trouble with the princes. It began with his challenge to the Duke of Brittany, and it didn't end there. Louis was overheard insulting the intelligence of the Duke of Bourbon and mocking the temper of Charles the Bold, among several other unfortunate utterances. Even beyond the material interests at stake, these were touchy, prideful individuals with the means to fight back. Insulting them, as Louis did, was a quick ticket to civil war. The princes had become talking among themselves as soon as Louis's tendencies toward royal power became clear. By early 1465, the game was up. Charles the Bold, the Duke of Brittany, the Duke of Bourbon, the Count of Armagnac, and numerous other important lords had formed a formal league against King Louis. Most damagingly of all, they had convinced Louis's younger brother Charles, the Duke of Berry, at this moment the heir to the throne, to join them as a figurehead. They called themselves the League of the Public Weal, La Ligue du Bien Public. They set about confiscating royal tax money and issued a steady stream of propaganda, attacking King Louis for his blatant assaults on tradition and the rights of the high nobility. There were other and more dangerous signs, too. Soldiers were massing in Britain. Charles the Bold had convinced his father, the elderly Duke Philip the Good, to raise an army. According to one commentator, old Philip thought the army was just for show, just a means of extracting concessions from King Louis. But Charles the Bold meant to use that Burgundian army. Whether he knew about the plot ahead of time or not, and it's not entirely clear either way, Louis was in serious trouble. One of his closest counselors even opened talks with the rebellious nobles about the possibility of capturing Louis and handing him over. Louis's only hope was to raise his own armies and call on his allies for aid. A few of the great lords remained loyal, and the Duke of Milan, a staunch ally, sent several thousand soldiers to aid Louis. As we've seen, there was no firm distinction between internal and external politics. I can't emphasize this enough. Louis had meddled in the Wars of the Roses. Queen Margaret of Anjou, the wife of the feckless Henry VI of England, was the child of one of those dynasties of French princes and looked to her family for help, naturally. And now the Duke of Milan was siding with one of the parties in this Guerre du Bien Public. It wasn't some great crime to play that side of the game. It was the nature of the game itself. And that was how Louis and Charles the Bold ended up drenched with sweat and blood on the field at Montelieri in July of 1465. The other rebel lords may have just been hoping to rein Louis in and win some concessions. Charles the Bold intended to bring the king to his knees. The battle had been fought near Paris. The capital was Charles's goal, and in the aftermath of the vicious draw at Montelieri, he and the other rebel lords set out to besiege the capital. When they arrived, they made their demands. The princes wanted control of the kingdom, including its finances, the distribution of its offices, the standing army, and, quote, the person and government of the king. In effect, they intended to defang the king and destroy independent royal power. This was the most extreme version of the claim to rights theme that we discussed above. To these nobles, in this context, their rights superseded practically all royal prerogatives, even the basic existence of the kingdom. Louis was in a heck of a pickle. He was surrounded by both nobles and commoners ready to give him up. He was short on allies, and his capital was besieged by superior armies. It would take sharp maneuvering to get him out of this jam. The Burgundian diplomat Philippe de Comines, who served both Charles the Bold and Louis XI and knew personally all the major players in this conflict, was a sharp observer of political life. Quote, among all those I have ever known, he wrote later, the most skillful at extricating himself out of a disagreeable predicament in time of adversity was King Louis XI. The king was ice cold under pressure. He was willing to admit his faults, and most of all, he was generous with his friends. All of those traits came into play here. He bargained for time, and he coolly told the rebel princes that their demands weren't realistic, but that he'd be happy to offer his brother, the heir, some territories, and he'd offer cash compensation to the others. In a face-to-face meeting with Charles the Bold, he turned up the charm and made him a separate offer of compensation. This was a sharp strategy. It was designed to divide the princes and draw their interests in different and mutually exclusive directions. As negotiations continued, Louis's situation appeared to deteriorate. But the king was playing the long game. Louis gave his brother the rich province of Normandy and handed over large chunks of territory to Charles the Bold. These were major concessions, but since these key players had been satisfied, their interests were no longer aligned with the other rebel princes. The Duke of Brittany got some minor lands. Minor offices and subsidies would have to suffice for a couple of others, and the Duke of Bourbon, one of the original ringleaders, got a pension and a governorship. Now, Louis had given up a great deal of land, money, and prestige, but he had succeeded in breaking up the prince's alliance. For the moment, he had saved royal government, but the fight was far from over. Within months, he retook Normandy from his brother and won over the Duke of Brittany to his side with a big pot of money. When Brittany wavered, Louis's armies forced the Duke to surrender and break his alliance with Charles the Bold and Burgundy. At various points in the next decade, Charles the Bold and the Duke of Brittany negotiated with Edward IV of England to bring English armies into the fray. The king and the dukes fought constantly. It took until 1477 and a great deal of sharp maneuvering for Louis to finally bring Charles the Bold down. Brittany was brought to obedience in 1475, but it wouldn't become part of France proper until the 1480s, when Louis's son Charles VIII married Anne, the heiress to the duchy. Up until the very end of the 15th century and even beyond, overmighty princes and their ambitions continued to plague the French crown. This was built into the structure of the political system. It wasn't destiny that the king would eventually win these battles, and it took all of Louis XI's talent to eke out bloody draws until he could finally prevail. This was as much luck as skill. If things had gone just a bit differently, if the bastard of Burgundy had speared Louis instead of his horse at Montelieri in 1465, for example, France might have ceased to exist altogether.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
While Louis XI was dealing with his many enemies both inside and outside France, conflict was brewing south of the Pyrenees. The Iberian Peninsula was home to several separate Christian kingdoms, along with a Muslim rump in the south. These included Portugal, which we talked about back in the episodes on exploration, Castile, which included most of the center and south, minus Muslim Granada, and Aragon in the east, which included Catalonia around Barcelona. By the 1450s, Aragon and Castile were both ruled by members of the same dynasty, the Trastámaras. These were powerful states, but Aragon and Castile were both rocked by civil wars in the second half of the 15th century. Let's start with Castile. Up until the reign of Ferdinand and Isabella, which began in 1474, Castile had much more in common with the relatively weak royal government of France than the strong royal government of England. Castile's nobles were exceptionally powerful, and its kings were weak for most of the 15th century. It took extraordinarily capable rulers, especially Isabella, and widespread disaffection with the nobles to eventually push through the reforms that made a united Spain one of the strongest states of the 16th century. By the time Enrique IV took the throne of Castile in 1454, generations of weak kingship had taken their toll. civil war after civil war had rocked the realm. This was partially personal and partially structural. Enrique's father, John II, hadn't been a particularly gifted man. He had been imprisoned and sidelined by his powerful royal cousins, a couple of guys called the Infantes of Aragon, who held vast lands in both Castile and in neighboring Aragon. For most of his reign, John II was controlled by his friend and favorite, Don Álvaro de Luna, a talented and intelligent man. There had been an open battle in 1445, where Don Álvaro defeated a noble coalition but failed to end their cause. In 1453, after years of overreaching and failure, Álvaro de Luna was publicly beheaded on John II's orders. Maybe unable to deal with this act, the king died the next year. The nobles were just too strong. Their interests were too deeply embedded in the structure of Castile's government. These are complicated conflicts that would take whole episodes to describe in any detail, but suffice to say that the basic conflict was over what royal government could legally do, who, either officials or the great nobles, would administer it, and who would collect its rewards. Now, Enrique IV has gotten a bad rap pretty much from the time of his actual reign. Quote, eccentric and much maligned is how the historian Teofilo Ruiz describes him. Other assessments have ranged from insane to impotent to sexually debauched to power hungry to actually gifted. But ultimately, Enrique was simply incapable. He had great plans for his realm and for the role of the king within it, but he lacked the ability or the resources to carry these plans out. This was the basic problem that would plague his entire reign. Enrique's rule began promisingly enough. Because he didn't yet have an heir, and because of the execution of Álvaro de Luna, he had huge landed estates in his possession. This gave him revenue and power to share, if he played his cards right. Enrique pardoned many of those imprisoned or exiled during his father's reign. With an eye to neutering his enemies among the high nobility, he picked promising lower nobles and raised them up the ranks with grants of office and land. The royal officials he appointed were often highly educated university graduates. They were much more likely to be personally loyal to the king than the great nobles. On Enrique's orders, officials flexed their muscles as magistrates and on town councils, but especially as corregidores. These corregidores were royal officials who went out into the kingdom to explore royal prerogatives and enforce them wherever possible. To build his ties within Iberia, Enrique married the daughter of the king of Portugal. He made good economic policy and strengthened trading ties with wealthy Flanders. Most of all, Enrique made war on the Muslims of Granada in the south of Spain. From 1455 to 1458, campaigns went out and took strategic positions, including Gibraltar. This was a tightly controlled approach and one that paid for itself. Because of the religious dimension of the conflict, Enrique was able to get both crusade taxes from the Pope and taxes from the Cortes, Castile's representative body. But all was not well, and problems started to show up very quickly. The nobles disliked Enrique's piecemeal approach to war with Granada. When Enrique's daughter and heir Juana was born in 1462, there were loud whispers that Enrique was impotent and that she was illegitimate. According to plausible rumors, Juana was actually the daughter of one of Enrique's favorite nobles, a guy named Beltrán de la Cueva. The rumor stuck enough that Juana was known as La Beltraneja. Most of all, the high nobility disliked Enrique's elevation of low-born nobles, the way that Enrique was dividing up the benefits of royal government. By 1464, just 10 years into Enrique's reign, things had fallen apart. The great noble families like the Mendozas and the Villenas had split into factions. Each faction wanted to control a figurehead ruler and the possible spoils of royal government. That figurehead ruler didn't have to be Enrique. It could just as easily be his half-brother Alfonso or his half-sister Isabella, who was 13 years old in 1464. Yes, that Isabella, the one who eventually funded Columbus and did a bunch of other really important stuff. Enrique's failings showed just how difficult the path was for kings of this age who wanted to strengthen royal government. Even the talented ones, like Louis XI, were faced with serious obstacles. Enrique IV of Castile was no Louis XI. Matters came to a head in 1464, with a series of plots by one noble faction to seize Enrique and force him to name their candidate as heir to the throne. Enrique eventually escaped, but he had to capitulate to their demands anyway. The new heir was to be Alfonso, Enrique's half-brother and the sister of Isabella. Things got even worse the following year. Events culminated in an effigy of Enrique being placed on a stage outside the town of Avila, where it was then stripped of its crown, sword, and scepter and kicked off stage. This was bizarre, but it amounted to a ritual deposition of a king who was in serious trouble. At this point, there were three possible heirs: Juana, the maybe daughter of Enrique, Alfonso, whom one noble faction was already treating as king, and finally, less likely, Isabella, who as a 14-year-old in 1465 was the object of much plotting and maneuvering as a target for marriage alliances. Every noble clan in Castile and several foreign kings wanted her hand in marriage. Because of Castile's inheritance laws, which allowed for succession through the female line, Isabella had a claim on the throne. The right backers could turn her into a strong candidate. This was even more the case after Alfonso died unexpectedly in 1468. After Enrique's wife, the queen, was found having an affair with another man, little Princess Juana's paternity was thrown into even greater question. Now, Isabella was the only really viable heir. Enrique acknowledged the inevitable and formally named Isabella his successor, removing his daughter Juana from that position. At this point, the issue of Isabella's marriage took on even greater importance. The entire Kingdom of Castile, potentially one of Europe's great powers, would come with her in any potential match. Louis XI of France wanted to marry her to his useless brother, Charles, the Duke of Berry. Edward IV of England was already married to Elizabeth Woodville, but his brother Richard, the Duke of Gloucester, was a possibility. King Afonso V of Portugal dearly wanted to marry her himself. All of these were possibilities, but the strongest one was a young man named Ferdinand, the Prince of Aragon. Ferdinand was Isabella's cousin and a member of the same dynasty, the Trastámaras. But he was also the most dangerous option politically. Aragon was a neighbor, and relations between the two kingdoms had been on edge for years. The match with Ferdinand was explicitly against King Enrique's orders. He was planning on marrying his daughter Juana to Ferdinand, and Isabella had to maneuver on her own behalf to make it happen. Those maneuvers included a desperate flight out of Enrique's reach to ensure that the marriage would happen, along with an incisive letter-writing campaign on her own behalf. Quote, "By my letters and messengers, I now notify your highness of my determined will concerning my marriage," she wrote to Enrique after her exit. It was not for an impotent king to make her decision for her, but for the future queen of Castile, not yet 18 years old, to decide what was best for the realm. Isabella had chosen wisely. She was highly intelligent and driven, well-educated, and had already developed a political style one historian appropriately calls, quote, "meek grandeur." That quality is visible in the quotation I mentioned above. She acknowledges Enrique as king, but she's making her own decisions, thank you very much. Ferdinand was an excellent complement to her personal qualities. Fit, bright-eyed, smart, charismatic, already an experienced soldier at just 17, and like Isabella, perfectly comfortable with a heavy workload. He had an easy way with people and would grow into a master manipulator in his later years. Where Isabella inspired loyalty, Ferdinand could bend people to his will. They were a perfect and complementary match. Two talented people who, together, were worth more than the sum of their already considerable parts. After their marriage in October of 1469, Isabella and Ferdinand spent the next 5 years preparing to take the realm. They did so in 1474, when Enrique IV finally died. But this wasn't the end of the conflict. Juana, Enrique's daughter, married Afonso V, the King of Portugal. Afonso was determined to press his 13-year-old wife's claim to the throne of Castile, and several factions of Castilian nobles were perfectly happy to take Juana's and Afonso's side. The two sides fought a major battle at Toro in 1476. It was a partial victory for Isabella and Ferdinand, who led his wife Isabella's army, but the royal couple managed to turn it into a major propaganda coup. In the immediate aftermath of the battle, they sent messengers to every major town in Castile boasting about their victory. The war didn't officially end until 1479, but Juana's fate was effectively sealed. She renounced her claim on the throne of Castile, and her marriage to Afonso of Portugal was annulled. When Ferdinand's father died in 1479, and he officially became King of Aragon, two of Iberia's three major kingdoms were united in the royal couple. Isabella and Ferdinand inaugurated a series of deep and fundamental reforms that extended royal power and government. They made war on the Muslims of Granada, and on the side, they found funding for a cocky Genoese adventurer named Christopher Columbus. the nobility didn't go away, and in fact, they gained a great deal from the eventual conquest of Granada. But Ferdinand and Isabella pursued royal rights with a vengeance and made Castile, Aragon, and eventually the united Spain a much more coherent kingdom. Ferdinand's kingdom of Aragon had suffered its own share of internal instability in the preceding decades. This disorder wasn't as long-lasting or as deep as the almost total breakdown in Castile during Enrique IV's reign, but it was still indicative of the spirit of the times in one major regard. It illustrates the basic incoherence of late medieval kingdoms and how other kingdoms could take an active hand in what might seem to us internal affairs. As a kingdom, Aragon was a bit of an odd beast. Formally, it was composed of three parts: Aragon proper, Valencia, and Catalonia, centered around the major trading port of Barcelona. The kings of Aragon also acquired some overseas possessions, including Sicily and the Kingdom of Naples. The instability within Aragon was largely a product of the composite nature of the kingdom, and mostly confined to Catalonia. Catalonia had a strong sense of its own identity. Although it had been united with Aragon since 1137, it retained its own political structures, namely a powerful representative body called the Cortes. Catalonia was rich and independent-minded. It had its own complex politics and internal divisions, between factions within its key city of Barcelona, between landlords and peasants, and between towns and nobility. To make matters even more complicated, these various factions all aligned themselves with factions of the nobility and different members of the Aragonese royal family, who all had their own interests to pursue. In 1462, several things happened in Catalonia in rapid succession. First, rightfully unhappy with the rule of King John II, a faction of Catalans offered the rule of Catalonia to Enrique IV of Castile. The King of Castile sent armies to secure it. Next, the Catalan peasantry rebelled. And finally, John II brokered an alliance with King Louis XI of France and invaded his own lands. Enrique IV withdrew at the urging of King Louis XI of France, and at various points, Louis aided each side, with the ultimate aim of completely annexing Catalonia to France. The Catalans themselves elected a French prince of the blood named René of Anjou king. This added yet another complex dimension to the conflict. It took until 1472, when John II finally took Barcelona, to bring the conflict to an end. Wisely, John II extended clemency to the defeated Catalans, and his son Ferdinand ruled there with a light touch and a great deal of respect for Catalan liberties afterward. At heart, this was a conflict about rights. The rights of the nobles of Catalonia, the rights of the peasants who rose up in revolt, the rights of towns, the rights of representative assemblies, and the rights of the king. Each of those groups of actors made claims and then tried to defend them in open battle against ever-shifting alliances, which often involved foreign powers. If all of that sounds confusing, not just what happened in Aragon, but also in Castile, France, and England, well, it should. That's the nature of late medieval politics and the conflicts that grew out of it. So with that in mind, let's return to the three themes we talked about at the beginning: personal politics, claims to rights, and the incoherence of kingdoms as political units. Let's start with that last one first, the incoherence of kingdoms. At various points in this episode, I've talked about these conflicts as quote-unquote civil wars. That's commonly how the Wars of the Roses are discussed, and the same goes for the War of the Public Weal in France. It's less the case in Iberia, where the kingdoms were so closely linked to each other by dynastic ties and widespread noble holdings, but even there the term crops up. Civil war implies internal conflict. But, as we've seen, internal doesn't mean a lot in this period. These were conflicts within kingdoms, yes, but the rulers of other territories played key roles. Louis XI was an active participant in the Wars of the Roses. He supported his cousin, Queen Margaret, and the Lancastrians, and we saw just how he played both sides in the Catalan Civil War. He also tried to secure a marriage between his brother and Isabella of Castile, a move that surely would have drawn him into the ongoing conflict there. In Castile, John II of Aragon was a player in their decades of instability, and so were other members of the Aragonese royal family, like the Infantes of Aragon I mentioned earlier. The quote-unquote War of Castilian Succession that eventually confirmed Isabella as Queen of Castile had her defeating an army sent by the King of Portugal. Isabella's husband, the heir to the throne of Aragon, led her army. When Edward IV of England was forced to flee his kingdom in 1470, he went to the lands of the Duke of Burgundy, Charles the Bold. Charles the Bold was his brother-in-law, and he provided King Edward with money, ships, and soldiers for his victorious return. Edward IV, for his part, supported Charles the Bold and the Duke of Brittany in their struggles with Louis XI. The King of England even tried to include John II of Aragon and the King of Castile in a league, along with Charles the Bold, against Louis XI. These civil wars were all connected because political actors in one war were all players in the others. In a really basic sense, kingdoms were porous. They were full of political actors, mostly nobles, but also towns and representative assemblies. These actors had ties to the rulers of a given kingdom. Now, Barcelona to John II of Aragon, the Earl of Warwick to Edward IV, the Duke of Burgundy to Louis XI. But they were also forces with their own ideas and ties. Even more than that, they had a strong sense of their own rights, the second of our three major themes. Charles the Bold had rights within his territories, even those territories he held as part of the Kingdom of France. He felt those rights were threatened by Louis XI, and so did the other princes of France who rebelled with him. Louis XI, conversely, believed that his royal rights superseded those of even his most powerful vassals, like the Dukes of Burgundy and Brittany. The beheaded would-be King Richard, Duke of York, felt that he had rights to govern England as its preeminent nobleman. Beyond that, Richard, Duke of York, believed that he had the right to take violent action against the faction that controlled the king in order to assert his right to govern. The factions who fought for control of the city of Barcelona believed they had the right to be ruled by a king of their choosing. It didn't have to be John II of Aragon, whatever he claimed. For his part, John II believed that his claim to Catalonia gave him the right to cede pieces of Catalonia to Louis XI of France in return for his support in taking it back from the rebels. At heart, all of these conflicts were about the rights that different political actors claimed and the lengths they would go to in order to defend those claims to rights. A kingdom didn't have some objective existence. It was really nothing more than a bunch of claims to rights collected in the person of the king. The king wasn't just the king. He had a claim to the title of king with its attendant rights. The king didn't have the right to levy a tax. He claimed the right. He didn't have the right to enforce royal justice. He claimed the right. He didn't have the right to conduct diplomacy and make war. He claimed the right. Everybody agreed that royal power was special, but the rights themselves were always subject to resistance from other competing claims. In this period, the tensions between those competing claims lent themselves to sustained and often violent conflict. In the extreme version, other political actors could render the king's claims, and the whole kingdom itself, non-existent. This brings us back to the first of our three themes, the personal side of politics. Outside Aragon, we see a distinct pattern of relatively weak and/or unfortunate kings who let royal power wither. They were then followed by strong and talented kings who worked hard to extend royal power. Now, that first generation of weak kings struggled for various reasons. Enrique IV of Castile wanted to be a strong king, but he had terrible instincts for wielding royal power, and his impotence helped to create a succession crisis. Henry VI of England simply wasn't there in any real sense. He had neither the will to claim royal power nor the ability to use it. This created fertile ground for others to fight over royal power. These were personal characteristics. They belonged to the kings themselves. Now, to be clear, this isn't great man history, where it's just a succession of important people doing things. But they interacted with the structures of politics in distinct ways that created conflict and political breakdowns. Now, conversely, Edward IV's personal charisma, Louis XI's coolness under pressure, Isabella's keen intelligence, these were all qualities that enabled the rulers in question to dramatically expand royal power in a structural sense. Personality and personal relationships mattered here. When we put these three themes together, when we look at these civil wars together as a unit, what we see is a common political culture and a common political trajectory in Western Europe. That is why all this matters. Now, there were substantial differences between kingdoms. England was more centralized, France was looser, the nobles were more powerful in Castile, the representative bodies were weaker in France, the towns were stronger in Aragon, and so on. But what they shared in common was far more important than where they differed. The basic structure of the political system revolved around the king and royal power, the nobility, representative bodies, and towns or cities. there were a lot of moving pieces in these systems and a lot of opportunities for conflict. The particular conditions in the second half of the 15th century brought those opportunities into the open. Because of the porous and open nature of these kingdoms, all of these conflicts were connected with one another. The relationship between the King of France and the Duke of Burgundy affected civil wars in England and Castile, and so on. It's not just that the similar political setup in these kingdoms generated similar kinds of conflict at similar points of friction. These conflicts were all literally linked, so that conflict in one place fed conflict in another. This was all one political network stretching from Wales to Gibraltar to the Rhine and beyond. Next time on Tides, we'll be exploring one particularly fascinating piece of that political landscape, the lands of the Dukes of Burgundy, the last of whom was the Charles the Bold we talked about today. For four generations, the Dukes of Burgundy collected lands and titles, assembling a heterogeneous mixture of duchies and counties and towns into something that was almost a kingdom in its own right. They were fabulously wealthy and famously chivalrous, patrons of art and military innovators. Then, in the blink of an eye, they disappeared. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound designer for this episode is Lindsey Graham. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.